Hey, Corey here. We've had an influx of new listeners, and so I just want to make sure that if you are new to the podcast, you don't just jump in and start listening to these daily episodes, which we've been doing. Please go back and listen to the first at least 8 episodes so you have an idea of what Collapse is, what it is that Corey is talking about. Also, if you've been with us for a while and you're enjoying the content, please join us on Patreon. We would love to see you there. There's a link, as always, in the description. Hey folks, as you know, we have recently been speaking quite a bit about microplastics on the podcast, and I thought today could be a bit of a refreshing episode, an interview that I did with someone named Sam Baker. He's the CEO and founder of a company called Wiggle Brew. It's not often on the podcast that we talk about people who are trying to make a positive difference and showcasing what they are doing, the research and the dedication they're putting towards it. Today's interview is with Sam, who started this company in an effort to help the planet, you know, not use phosphate fertilizers. But even more than that, they are doing some very, very interesting research around how to properly break down and, I guess you could call it, recycle plastic. I don't know that recycle is the right word, but essentially turning microplastics or plastics back into nutrient-rich soil. So super fascinating concept. I hope you enjoy this. You know, the world has so many problems, right? We've got a million things that we're trying to solve. Would solving this one issue of plastics save us all from collapse? Well, you know my feelings on that. But I do think that it is important that if we're going to go down, let's go down fighting. And that is something that Sam Baker is doing. So without further ado, here is Sam. Okay, Sam, thanks for joining me on the podcast. It's awesome to have you here.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
Yeah. So before we dive into your company and your research and kind of the cool things that you're starting, I wanted to ask you maybe if you could describe a little bit about like your background, your story for how you got to this point. You know, who is Sam Baker?
So I am, and it's always weird to say this, I am the CEO and founder of Wriggle Brew. And Wriggle Brew is an environmental startup. We work on producing organic fertilizer that causes a lot less damage to the environment. And we also do a bit of work in the world of plastic digestion, plastic bioremediation. So we've been working on solutions to use earthworms and microorganisms to turn lots of kinds of plastic waste back into soil and into fertilizer. And how I got into it is always kind of a fun story because it's very odd. I was not interested in earthworms or knew much about earthworms at all when I started. I was a chemistry student at the University of Central Florida, and I was very interested in pyrotechnics and in a number of very unrelated subjects. And there ended up being an environmental event that kind of set this whole thing off, and that was in the summer of 2019, we had a bunch of fertilizer runoff events across the state of Florida.
Yeah.
And so a lot of people don't know this, but the use of industrial fertilizer, which is something that's very important for growing food and preventing all of us from starving, has some extremely negative side effects. And one of those is that it destroys waterways. And the overuse of this industrial fertilizer in my home state in Florida for housing developments and nurseries and things like that ended up wiping out all the fish in a pond I used to go fishing out with my grandpa. And it was a very shocking moment to me. And so I ended up inquiring my best friend Gabe about what to do, because it's one of those moments where you realize that if nothing is done about the repetitive damage that we're doing through our industrial activities, that it's not going to get better, and it's just going to get worse and worse and worse and worse. And eventually there will be nowhere left to go fishing. And, yeah, you know, we'll be living on a sandbar that's completely ecologically dead. So I went to Gabe and asked him what his thoughts were, because he's quite a bit smarter than me. He was a biochemistry student, and he proposed that we use earthworms to make fertilizer, because earthworms can eat garbage, lots of organic waste material, and poop out worm castings, a kind of material that rivals industrial fertilizers for its efficacy. And so we went after that, and many years later, now we're actually running a business producing worm poop fertilizer full time and sending it out to actual industrial scale farms.
Awesome. So that's a process called, I think it's vermicomposting. Is that right?
That's exactly right. Yes.
For people that don't want to call it worm poop soil.
Yeah, so the technical term is vermicomposting. You take some kind of organic material as a food, you put it into a big composter or bin, which is inhabited by a large number of earthworms, and in several weeks they will eat through it and work it into new humus, new topsoil.
Yeah. And this is a pretty common practice. There's lots of companies that do this at scale. So how long have you been doing that?
Certainly. So it's definitely common to farm worms, and in fact, a lot of people even do this in their backyards, and I encourage you, if you are a person who gardens or homesteads, to go and look into that. We've been doing this now since 2020, essentially. And so this is 5 years into the research side of things. We actually only started the business in 2022, so we're 3 years into the business side of it. But we are the only company, as far as I'm aware, so far, that has transitioned into not just making the worm manure, the worm poop, but we also produce a liquid variety. So we produce worm tea, which is what it's called traditionally, and we are the only ones who make a shelf-stable version of that that farms can actually use on an industrial scale. And that's our big differentiator, is that we make worm tea in a way that can actually be used by big ag,
Okay.
and won't go bad.
So they are taking that worm tea and they are diluting it with water and then spreading it over existing soil. Is that how that works?
Yeah, exactly. And into crops. So it's, believe it or not, it's actually being used to grow things like soy and corn, which are, very, very margin sensitive row crops. We're growing them with 30 ounces to the acre, roughly, of Wriggle Brew. And we're growing them in very large quantities, and they're having really good results. So it is, to my mind, one of the first times we are seeing an organic fertilizer actually supplant a synthetic nitrogen or phosphorus fertilizer and do so in a way that isn't costing the farmer more.
Yeah, because typically, the reason that they're buying the unhealthy for the planet fertilizers with the mass amounts of phosphorus and all these things, is because it's cheaper, right? It's
Oh, yeah.
way easier at scale to buy these fertilizers. But you're saying you're making it so that it's at least cost effective to do it in a more environmentally friendly way.
Right, and that's the real like hell of this whole crisis, is that back in the 1960s and 70s, we were facing the potential of mass starvation. So the world was approaching 3 to 4 billion people at the time, and our agricultural systems were pushed to the absolute limit. We were very fortunate we had something known as the Green Revolution happen. And so the Green Revolution was this mass adoption of synthetic fertilizers, phosphorus, nitrogen fertilizers, also the mass adoption of the very first GMOs, the mass adoption of some basic genetic modification in plants. And this basically saved the planet, at least it kicked the apocalypse down the road a few decades. And so it allowed us to continue growing exponentially in population without all starving to death in the 1980s. And the cost from that is that we are now discovering that the use of nitrogen, the use of phosphorus, these artificial compounds, is extremely terrible to the soil, and it's extremely unsustainable. The nitrogen we produce comes from natural gas. It's not something we have an infinite amount of. The phosphorus has to be mined out of the ground. So it's like coal and oil. In fact, it's a byproduct of the petroleum industry, at least nitrogen is. So it's not sustainable. It's not something that can keep going forever. And so organic fertilizers, we've been working on alternatives in the organic world for decades to try and, come up with something that will work as well as these synthetic monstrosities will, but won't run out on us and won't become toxic to the environment. But so far, most of these organic options have failed pretty horrifically. Sri Lanka is a great example. The country of Sri Lanka recently attempted to switch their entire agricultural system over to compost and over to permaculture,
Yep.
and their farms failed on a massive scale, and it
Yeah.
led to basically their economy collapsing.
They collapsed, yep.
Yeah, it was horrific for those people. And so this is because of the inefficiencies of most organic fertilizers. And another problem is that many of the organic fertilizers that are actually efficient are really, really expensive. So it's all about profit with farmers at the end of the day. Farmers are one of the oldest businesses in humanity. They need to make a profit to survive. If they have to spend more money to get an organic fertilizer that won't work as well or won't be as consistent as a synthetic fertilizer, they're not going to do it, or they're going to do it and they're going to go out of business. So
Right.
what made worm tea unique, and what makes it to me inspiring and a thing we should be hopeful about, is that biochemically it has the capacity to rival synthetic fertilizers for efficacy. So it can do better than they can, ounce per ounce, comparing one to one. And because it's made with worm castings, which are a kind of waste product that can be produced from the abundant food and farm waste we have, if you do it right, you can make it cheaper and domestically, which is something you cannot do with the nitrogen and phosphorus compounds. And we have been able to do that at scale, or at least at a scale large enough to get into the tens of thousands of gallons, which is now feeding several hundred thousand acres in the US. And as far as we know, other organic or fertilizers that quite nail that Venn diagram. And so I'm very proud of Wriggle Brew for this, and I think it's something that could make a very big difference in solving this massive fertilizer challenge.
Awesome. I love that. So, a couple questions on that before we get into the plastic part, because the plastic part is like the really crux of this conversation, but this part is really interesting to me as well. So, you're making this worm tea. Are you also getting compost out of it as well, or is it all made into the tea and then the castings are ejected, or how does that work?
That's a very good question. So yeah, we actually do end up with a compost kind of material that comes out of this. So we start with worm castings, vermicompost. And that material is really, really nutrient rich. It has a lot of solubles in it. It's fantastic for growing things. We use that almost like a coffee grind or a coffee bean. We extract the nutrients from that. And then we end up with a liqueur, with a leachate, with a tea, or at least with the precursor to what will become our tea. And then we are left behind with a bunch of worm castings that have no more solubles in them. Now, the good news is worm castings are not just useful because of the solubles. They also have a lot of really good physical characteristics. They have good carbon content in them. They have excellent aeration breathability. And so what we do with that leftover worm casting is we actually send that to farmers to help them rebuild their soil. Because a lot of farmers, they have very, very poor soil after decades of pulling calories out of it. So by giving them the excess worm castings, the spent castings, it helps them rebuild some of that topsoil. And because for us it's kind of a waste product, I mean, we are selling it, but it's kind of a waste product, we can sell it to them very, very cheap.
Okay.
And that allows them to buy lots of it and use lots of it. And then, of course, when you combine those physical worm castings back with a worm tea, a controlled worm tea like the one we make, you get the best of both worlds on that farm, and that farm can really flourish.
Okay. So, if you were to sell the castings, just from a business perspective here, I like to think about things from a business perspective because that's what makes the world run, frankly.
Absolutely, yeah.
If you were to sell the castings without extracting the tea, basically, they would be more nutrient rich. You could sell the castings for a little bit more, but and that the castings would have more value to the farmer than the waste product that you end up with. But the waste product still has compostable. It's still compost. It still has that value that's going to add to this to the farmer's soil. You sell it for a lot cheaper than you would if it was just. If it was still had the you call them solubles, is that what you call
Yeah,
them?
yeah.
Okay. But the tea is where like the real value comes in because you can dilute that, you can spread it. Like you said, it's what did you say, 30 ounces per acre or
That's
something
right,
like
yeah.
that. So that helps to kind of spread and make use of those nutrients more efficiently instead of having them just being tilled into the soil through compost, basically.
And there's a big infrastructure efficiency. So most farms do not really have the capacity to spread worm castings.
Okay.
And the other thing is, worm castings can only be used at the beginning of a season. So before you've thrown any seeds down. So it becomes very time sensitive. And a
Yeah.
lot of farms may not be willing to do that. they may actually like their soil as it is, or they may not have, like I said, the equipment. But almost all farms have the equipment to handle the liquid. So we can ship them the organic liquid, and it's a one-to-one replacement for the synthetic liquid, this for the synthetic fertilizer that they're using. And
Okay.
because of that, they don't have to make any big investments in changing how they're farming. They can use their very well-established system and still be much more efficient and be kind of organic.
So from a like ounce to ounce cost perspective, what is a farmer going to pay for Wiggle Brew tea versus a phosphorus fertilizer?
So right now it's pretty much competitive. So most nitrogen and phosphorus synthetic fertilizers tend to be something like $6 to $14 to the gallon, $6 to $12, $6 to $14 to the gallon, in that range. And Wriggle Brew tends to be like $8 to $12 to the gallon. So it's not cheaper than the cheapest, but it's definitely cheaper than the most expensive.
Awesome.
So it's pretty comparable at the moment, though we are working on getting that price lower right now. And one of the big advantages we have is that a lot of those synthetic fertilizers are impacted by tariffs. They're impacted by volatility in the market. Now, for example, we talked about this before. In 2022, when the Ukraine war kicked off, the price of fertilizer in some cases went up 400%. So if there are any other major crises, like China invades Taiwan, India and Pakistan go to war, fertilizer prices are going to be one of the first things that are going to be going crazy because they're affected by shipping, they're affected by trade routes. A lot of our natural gas comes from Kazakhstan, for example, and it flows down through the Middle East and out to, like Saudi Arabia or to India. So all the things happening in the world really impact fertilizer. And while you don't feel the impacts of fertilizer in food for maybe a season or so, the next season, you end up with food shortages and starvation. So having a domestic supply of fertilizer is not only really goods from a strategic perspective for our country, but it's also extremely important because it can allow us to be price stable. And price stability means a lot to farmers.
Absolutely. Yeah, especially right now with the with all the tariff activity that we're seeing. If you can offer a price that doesn't change while the big box, fertilizer companies are having to increase due to tariffs, then yeah, that's a great value add. So, all right. I have one more question about the business side that you kind of already got established, and then we'll jump in. I'm curious, when it comes to this to scale, do you know like how many tons of castings are you producing a year? Do you have that number?
So we're not producing much of the castings ourselves right now. We're working with a couple other worm farms to make
Okay.
those castings.
Yeah.
But next year, for example, we're planning on a combination of internal production, a small amount, and a large amount external production bringing into us about 700,000 pounds. So, that's a lot. I think
Yeah.
that's like 35,000 tons or something,
Maybe 35, 350 tons, something like that. It's a lot of tons. Yeah.
Yeah,
Yeah.
3,500 tons or something. It's an enormous amount, and that will turn into 300,000 gallons of fertilizer. Yeah, 350 tons. It's gonna be 350 tons and 300,000 gallons of fertilizer, roughly,
Wow.
depending on the breaks. And that is going to be well into the millions of acres of fertilizer.
It's awesome.
It's a huge, huge thing. I mean, this year we did 30,000 gallons and about 70,000 pounds. So it's a multiplication of 10, roughly,
That's awesome.
based on just the projections of the sales we already did and the interest from the farmers we already have. So, it could be even higher than that.
Okay. So you said that you think right now you're the only company that's making a shelf stable worm tea. I'm guessing that you have that patented. When it comes to saving the world from phosphorus fertilizers, it's going to take more than what you're probably going to be able to scale up to in the next few years, right?
Yes.
You're a business guy, so you've got the patent and you want to, like, obviously you want to protect your business and your business interests. I totally get it. How do you make it so that you can scale up or that you can offer, how does it scale to save, to stop phosphorus fertilizers worldwide? When you're, a small team in Florida.
No, it's a great question. And the answer is basically the McDonald's model. You know, it's licensing, it's franchising. It's taking the IP and packaging it up for someone else and saying, "Hey, for a royalty, you can do this, and here's exactly how, and we'll source all the ingredients and everything for you, and you can actually produce this in bulk for your customers." And it's not just a theoretical. We are actually starting our first royalty agreement right now.
Awesome.
And so we'll be licensing it out starting the next about a month or two to our first other production facility slash farmer. And what makes that really, really potent is it means that we could go to other countries. We could introduce this even to countries, for example, in Africa, countries in Europe, countries in Asia, where they may have no domestic fertilizer production at the moment, or where they have very limited fertilizer production. And we can introduce this model to them, and we can allow them to produce it from their own domestic food waste and their own domestic farm waste. And that will allow them to produce the fertilizer they need, scale to address the issues of their country, and make a network that's most efficient for that locality without us having to spawn a vast corporate, monster to
Sure.
try and navigate all of this.
Interesting. Okay, really cool. So, I'm here in the Western United States. I say I want to reduce the amount of phosphorus fertilizer in my area. So I come to you and I say, I will send, I'll pay you a royalty for every gallon that I sell. You just give me the IP. You tell me how to do it. You train me up on it or whatever. I can build my own worm farm. I can create my own castings. I can take those castings based on your model, sell the tea to my local farmers, and then just send you a bit of the revenue, basically.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, and in the US, we have enough, worm farmers in our network that, if someone wanted to license it from us here, they wouldn't even need to like set up their own worm farm or anything.
Right, they've
They
already got
basically
it.
could just set up a liquid production facility. And right now we're trying to work with people who have farmers they already sell to with other products. That way it's, they already have those like sales connections and they can immediately
Right.
jump into that network. But once we start trying to go to other countries, then it becomes much more of a challenge because then you need to have, worm
Right.
farming, then you need to have all those things kind of built in.
Have you thought about, I'm just curious in my business mind thinking, have you thought about setting up connections where, if it's me, instead of, let's say I just want to help the world, right? And I don't have any experience yet in like a worm farm, but I want to. Like I can build a worm farm. I'll do the research on that. But I don't want to have to do the sales side where I'm going out and I'm finding farmers and I'm, trying to sell them on this. Have you considered a model where it's like, basically, I become a contractor for you. I produce the tea and then you use your connections to sell the tea. So I sell you the tea at wholesale and you sell it to the farmers for retail at the end.
I had not thought about that, but that is an interesting model and it's something definitely worth considering because then you could have almost like a nodal network where you have a producer in a local area and he's making it for everyone in like the Pacific Northwest, for example. But he doesn't actually sell to any farmers there. He just manufactures it there. And then there's a central organization that has salespeople out there and then does the sales to those people out there.
Exactly.
That's
Yeah.
a very interesting idea, and I will consider that because it's not something I thought about before.
I know if, I've since you and I had an initial conversation, which just for my audience listening, you and I have spoken for about an hour about all of this, and we kind of talked about your business model and everything. I thought about it after, and I thought, if it really is me, and if I really do want to help, create a business of my own that can help. Then, but I don't have the time. I don't want to go spend the time learning about how to sell to farmers and all this stuff. If I knew that like it's a simple business model where I create the tea and I sell it to you for a lesser price at wholesale, but I know that I have someone to sell it to, then I can focus on the operation side of it. And I know that you're going to, you have the connections. Obviously, it doesn't work if you don't have a demand for the product. Like if you're producing already exactly the amount that you can sell, that's not going to be helpful. But if you have all these farmers who are begging for it and you just need more tea, then it's like, yeah, I'll help produce it and send it to you so that you can ship it on. So
Yeah,
anyway,
makes
just a
sense.
thought. Cool. Okay, let's get into like the kind of crux of the research. This part is really exciting to me and interesting. And I have some questions I want to ask you about this, lots of questions. But first, let's just have you kind of explain the
how you fell upon this plastics idea, and how have you gone from kind of A to Z? Or I guess at this point, you're probably still at like QRST because you got to get to Z still.
Yeah.
But yeah, explain to us how that all came about and what it is.
Certainly. So to give your listeners a bit more context, I mean, I'm sure everyone knows about plastic at this point, but plastic is probably one of the greatest environmental scourges of the 20th and 21st centuries.
Yeah.
It's a byproduct of petroleum. We make polymers out of it, these big complex chemical nets of carbon. We make everything out of it. Every product around us is practically made of plastic in one way or another. And that plastic ends up getting dumped into landfills and falling into the rivers and going into oceans. And it leads to the development of micro and nanoplastics, these tiny little flakes that break off from the main bits of plastic. And those we are now finding in every organ, in every human being ever studied. And it's estimated at this current moment that in any given person's brain, inside their brain, there is probably about a credit card's worth of plastic material scattered about in there.
Yeah.
We have no idea, at least on a global scale, how to deal with this problem. We are making more plastic all the time, to the tune of 100 billion pounds or so each year. And we are rapidly filling up landfills and other places with this material. And now we are learning it's related to behavioral problems, hormone problems, cancers. A vast number of maladies can be traced back to this material. So recycling has been tried and failed, and incineration has been tried and more or less failed, with some exceptions. It actually does work pretty well in Europe, for example. And so here in the U.S., we're just kind of dumping our plastic into landfills and trying to close our eyes and forget about it. But in spite of how toxic it is and how terrible it is, there are actually some organisms now adapting that are using this as an energy source, that are eating it. Since the 1970s, we've been identifying some kinds of bacteria and fungi degrading plastics, feeding on it to a very small degree. But in the late 2000s and the 2010s, they discovered that there are actually some larval worms, things like wax worms, mealworms, superworms, black soldier fly, that will not only be able to degrade these plastics, but they can actually eat and digest some kinds of plastics, mostly polystyrene foam, but also like polyvinyl foam, and eat it fully and use it to build up their bodies, to actually make biomass. So what's really crazy about that is this: these are the first macroorganisms ever discovered that are able to use plastic as a food source and subsist on it. And that is really, really crazy when you think about it, because of how toxic plastics are. Now, again, these macroorganisms have only ever been identified eating polystyrene foam, polyvinyl foam, EPA foam, stuff like that. So foam, soft, foamy plastics.
Which polystyrene, by the way, is one that we don't have a way to recycle right now. It fills landfills. It lasts for 500 years, at least in the environment.
Yes.
So it's one of the big problems for sure.
Yes. And in fact, it's one of the worst for producing micro nanoplastics. It lasts longer than almost any other plastics. And the little particles it makes are among the most toxic, because when it does get into the human body, it can start to turn into styrene oxide and other things like that, that are very strong carcinogens. But these organisms are eating it, and they're living off of it, and they're able to go through their whole life cycle eating nothing but this stuff. So it raises some really important questions, which is, if these larval worms have developed a microbiome advanced enough to subsist on some plastic foams, why aren't we doing anything with that? Why is that not being deployed to solve these mountains of plastic, to turn them into something? And
yeah,
especially too, when you think about this in the context of my business, we use the manure, the effluent mass matter created by earthworms, by worms, very similar to larvae, to produce fertilizer products. So can we take these larval worms, feed them plastics, and produce fertilizer from their manure?
Yeah.
And the answer is sort of. And that's what our research for the last 2 years has kind of been orbiting around. So we originally pitched a research proposal on some of the ideas we had to the National Science Foundation back in 2022. By 2023, they accepted it, and we won a $275,000 grant. And that was really, really huge for us, because it allowed us to get some really good equipment, but it allowed us to also, for several months, conduct research on worms eating plastic almost full time. And we discovered a lot of really interesting things. So we did a lot of first of their kind experiments. We found that larval worms can produce a manure from their fertilizer, or from their, or rather from their poop. They can produce a manure that can actually be used as a fertilizer. We also found that the isolation of the microbes from these larvae's guts can be used to power bioreactors that are far more efficient at digesting plastics than these actual larvae themselves are. And we also found... Oh, go ahead.
So just to clarify, at first you were just feeding worms plastic and saying, how efficient are they? What can they do? Okay, they're creating castings, worm poop that is compostable. Real quick, did you do research into that compost to make sure, like, are there nanoplastics in here? Are there?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. So that's actually a really, really important question, because yes, these worms will eat this plastic material, but what's coming out the other end? Is it pure poop, or is it poop laced with micro nanoplastics? Well, it's the latter. Yes, they are eating it, but they're not fully digesting. It's not going through their digestive tract and being broken down all the way. So their manure ends up laced with micro nanoplastic. And then on top of that, they're very messy eaters. So as they eat their way through these foams, they're spewing chunks of little tiny chunks of plastic everywhere.
Gotcha.
The other problem is the scalability. When they're not very healthy when we feed them plastics, it's barely enough to keep them alive. So when you scale up the size of a worm population to eat more plastic, disease starts to spread really easily.
Okay.
And so, yes, they can eat the plastic, but very quickly their populations start to suffer from all kinds of diseases, and they will actually die off quicker if you use more of them.
Okay. So this is unsustainable from a purely feeding the worms plastic. So what you were just saying here is, instead of just directly feeding worms plastic, what if we create a super worm by replicating their gut biome, their microbiome, in a bioreactor, which is just a controlled environment in which those same enzymes and microorganisms and stuff can live. You probably are trying to replicate the temperature, you're trying to replicate the amount of oxygen, aeration, and all of that stuff. And you're saying, let's just put the plastic in this, and our superworm can then kind of poop that out. And hopefully, by doing it this way, it's not laced with nanoplastics, because we're completely dissolving or completely digesting it. And hopefully it's also not spewing, it's not dirty, it's controlled within a, you know, a pressurized or whatever environment in which we can contain the plastics we're putting in it.
Exactly. You're right on the money. That's precisely our thinking, was how can we control this a little better? How can we isolate this? And can we take the worm out of the equation? Because the worm is very much a prima donna in this equation.
Sure.
So we set up a bioreactor, and in that bioreactor, we inoculate it with the kind of bacteria and maybe fungi that we're seeing inside of the worm's gut, and we start putting the plastic in there. And we find very quickly that the digestion is occurring at a much faster rate. It is occurring much more cleanly. And because we can let the bioreactor, because it's all liquid, we can let the bioreactor proceed on and on and on, we are getting very close to 100% digestion. So we're not detecting any traces of micro nanoplastics, no traces of oligomers, no traces of anything left over. And so that is huge, because what that means is, rather than, you know, try and have a very complicated system of worms eating plastic with all this waste going around, we can set up bioreactors that can scale industrially. Because a bioreactor is basically just like a big fermenter. It's like one of those things you'd see in a brewery, like one of those big stainless steel tanks.
Right, yep.
It's the same principle. So we can set those up, and we can have those digesting plastic material in a large facility. And so we could be taking in bulk plastic from, you know, grocery stores and farms and people's houses and landfills, processing it and breaking it down on the spot. And what was really amazing to us is that the speed of the digestion was really greatly increased. So in about 4 to 6 weeks with our best worms, we were able to achieve about 10 grams of plastic digestion, okay, which may not sound like a lot, and it isn't. It's a lot more than what we found in any other papers we read, but...
Sure. How many worms were working on that plastic?
About 100 worms.
Okay. Okay.
So, you know, it's okay. But when we made a bioreactor of a similar volume, so almost like a mason jar, a little bioreactor, we were finding that we were digesting 100 grams in 5 days. So it's 10
10xing.
Yep.
in like a tenth the time almost or something like
yes.
that.
Yes. So, okay. So it's way less time and it's way more digestion. And then we found that when we scaled the bioreactor up slightly, the rate of digestion increased. So there was a nonlinear relationship. So we were getting 450 grams, which is about a pound of plastic digested in 5 days. And that's really, really amazing.
Is that nonlinear relationship going to continue as you scale up the size of the bioreactor? If you have a brewery size, you know, 5,000 gallon bioreactor, is it going to scale up not linearly the amount of plastic that will be consumed?
I don't know. I don't know yet. I suspect probably not. At a certain point, there'll probably be, yeah, you know, there's probably like an S curve to it.
Sure.
But who knows how far that progression, you know, continues. It may be, you know, we get to 100 gallons before we start to see it taper off, or maybe it's 1,000, yeah, or maybe it's just 5. I don't know. But it's really exciting because it means that, I mean, even if this is the best rate you can get, we're talking about a 5-liter bioreactor digesting 1 pound of plastic in 5 days, you know, or 1 liter bioreactor, something. It's
yeah,
quite small.
Yeah.
So in 5 days, that is really, really fast. But then the question is, what's coming out of it? You know,
right,
what is that digestion yielding?
Yep.
And what it's yielding is a whole bunch of just secondary metabolites, the kind of stuff you would find in a worm's gut halfway through eating other kinds of food. So it's a bunch of organic acids. It's a bunch of, like, you know, proto sugars, basically, or things like phenolic acids. So all kinds of this stuff and a bunch of biomass from the dead microbes as well, that is biodegradable. And now it's mostly in a liquid state. It's like, you know, 99% liquid in there. But we can very quickly take that liquid and we can dump it on the ground and we can have it decompose just by pouring it out. Or what we found is you can take that liquid and you can make a kind of jello out of it. So you can throw like an agar, you can throw like a gelatin in it, and it will, yeah, gelatinize. It'll turn into a big blobby material.
Yeah.
And that can be blended up and fed to earthworms. And they will eat that with their regular food and you get worm castings out of it.
Fascinating. So you are recycling the plastic through the worm biome. You're then feeding that biome back to the worms. They consume it. They make castings. You can then make tea from the castings. You've turned plastic into worm tea, basically.
Exactly. And that's what this is. So I have here is PET plastic, and this PET plastic is, you know, this is what you find from like a water bottle, right? You can take a water bottle plastic and you convert it through the bioreactor into a mixture of organic acids. And that, once it's gelatinized and fed to worms, it yields a worm casting material right there.
Yeah. Okay.
And what's most amazing about that is it doesn't just work on one kind of plastic. So I was talking about the worms eating polystyrene, eating polyvinyl. Well, those work, but also it seems to work on LDPE, which is the plastic that plastic bags are made out of. It seems to work on PET, which is the plastic that bottles are made out of. It even seems to work to some degree on HDPE. HDPE is what a lot of the plastic components are made out of. It's what tables and chairs and TV backings are made
thicker,
out of.
Thicker, heavier plastic.
Exactly. Yeah. And it may work on almost, as far as we can determine, it may work on almost every kind of plastic out there right now, with a few exceptions. So, for example, probably won't work on PVC because of the chlorine content, and it may not work on a few others that have similar, you know, halogens or other things baked into them. But 80% of the plastics on the market could be affected by this process.
Did you find that it takes longer or different amounts of time to go through your bioreactor based on the plastic type?
Yes. Yes, it does. So the easier plastics are the things like polystyrene, LDPE, things like that, where the harder ones are more like PET and HDPE. So in the case of PET, you get benzoic acid is something that can come out of the degradation of it. And benzoic acid is antimicrobial. And so that has very strong limiting impacts on the growth of the bioreactor. But of course, these microbes produce all kinds of enzymes. So they produce enzymes to deal with almost all of these different compounds. So right now, what we're working on is modifying these bacteria so that they can produce all the time enzymes to degrade these plastics, rather than kind of wait until they get an environmental shock to start putting these enzymes out. And that has two advantages. One, I think it's going to definitely improve the efficiency of the bioreactor. But two, we may be able to harvest these enzymes once we reach scale And now we can ship those to places where plastic is sitting in the soil, or where plastic is sitting in someone's backyard, or where it's in a landfill. And we can sell it to them, and they can apply it and have the plastic break down in situ without having to introduce new or genetically engineered species of bacteria.
So this is the part where I find this part fascinating. The potential is huge. The research needed is also huge, I think, still at this point. There's a lot to know about, you know, how long will the enzymes survive in that environment? How deep into the soil are they going to go? Will they completely eradicate all the plastic there? Those types of questions.
Yes.
And I'm excited to hear kind of your research and how that comes out. Because, yeah, I can kind of imagine that ability to go, you know, crop dust the soil basically with these enzymes and have farms where microplastics don't exist in the soils and plants aren't taking them up. And I mean, that's huge value. That's amazing.
Yeah. And that's the dream. But of course, at the moment it is a dream. It's technically possible. From what our research shows, it's possible.
Right.
But it's a very long road to go from the possible to the actualized.
Right.
And we're going to need a lot of funding and a lot of help. And that's where things get a little more depressing. Because recently we were about to receive a $1.2 million grant. So we had NSF funding. We had the phase one NSF funding. And there was a phase two that we applied for. Phase two is a $1.2 million research grant. This, we designed a whole project around scaling this up, testing this to a larger degree, testing it in all kinds of different environments. Because we are a startup, so our funding is very, very limited.
Right.
And just as we were basically about to win this grant, we were told, like, hey, you're going to win, basically. All the grants start getting shut down. NSF's funding is, like, cut in half. All of the staff are being fired. The head of the NSF steps down. All the cuts that are happening right now just torpedoed our plan. And so now we're kind of in this weird space where we're scrambling to try and find, you know, new funding to do more of this plastic research. But it is dramatically slowed down our timeline, because when you have to self-fund, you go from having like 600,000 and change available for the year for that research to like 6,000 available.
Right. Yeah. And it makes a huge difference to scalability and research.
Yeah. And my guys, my group, we have to survive. We have lives, we have to live. And so I cannot ask them to work on, in good conscience, on research that will take a long, long time to complete if it jeopardizes the ability for the business itself to just to survive.
Right.
And this is a problem we see a lot in science these days, and it really kind of pisses me off that we're seeing it now throughout the SBIR world as well. But for example, back in the 70s and 80s, when we were first researching nuclear fusion power, there was this famous, you know, discussion with the government between some of the top researchers, and they were like, okay, how much money do you need to make this? And they're like, well, if we receive, you know, X amount of funding, we can have practical nuclear fusion power as soon as, you know, next 20 or 30 years. If we get half that, it might be like 50 years. If we get half that, who knows how long it'll be.
Right.
And they got like 5% of what they asked for.
Of course.
So everyone always jokes about like nuclear fusion being, you know, oh, it's just 20 years away, or it's just 10 years away. Well, the reason it's been like that is because we never funded it. Right now, nuclear fusion is finally getting some traction, funded by private equity. It's not,
right.
It's still not really funded by the United States, even though the advantages to having that are massive. And I think it's the same sort of deal with this. We have known about plastic degrading enzymes and bacteria for decades, but no one has done much with it. And now my group, we've made something of a small breakthrough with it, but you know, there's no readily available funding for this. There's plenty of venture capitalists who come to me all the time and say, yeah, we'll give you $250,000 for 30% of your company. But that's only going to get you through like the first 10% of the research necessary to start doing something with this.
Right.
And now you're married to a venture capitalist who will sell your company for parts as soon as it becomes inconvenient.
Yep. So you guys face this sort of issue where like you could just take the polystyrene and just focus on that and just focus on creating, like, you could scale up your bioreactors from, you know, from like gallon jugs or jars to like, you know, a 50 gallon or 100 gallon tank, and you could start processing plastics and polystyrene, and it would still, I mean, the time that it would take to just build up from there, we produce 5 to 6 billion pounds of polystyrene in the US per year. This is, yeah. I mean, just styrofoam, basically.
Yes.
And of course, the plastic problems is you know, way, way beyond that. So, and then you're talking about this other research, like maybe we could go out and we could figure out how to drop these enzymes on fields and create like a freeze-dried version that they can mix with water so it's shelf-stable and it can last a long time, et cetera, et cetera. It's like scope creep, but it's scope creep that is so necessary to the survival of humanity yeah. in regards to plastics, but there's no money for it.
No.
I can see the frustration and like the sort of cognitive dissonance of being like, we're right here on the edge of what we feel is a breakthrough, but like all of a sudden our even 1.2 million is a lot of money, but it's not enough money and it's gone. I saw the news since you and I spoke last week that the NSF, all the grants were basically shut down formally. And so I thought, oh no, poor Sam, like they've lost all their funding. What's next? Hopefully there are private investors who are willing to invest and want to do it for sure, a little profit, but mostly to like solve the plastics problem. But yeah, wow, what a conundrum you face.
It is, and it's a conundrum faced by a lot of scientists and a lot of people in the research world. And it's something our system is not well designed to deal with, because we are very much a culture and a society of short-term profit and of,
totally.
You know, what's my ROI? What's my RAS? And we want to know that fast. And it's very, very difficult for our society to, you know, plant trees in whose shade old men, you know, there's that famous saying, societies grow wise when old men plant trees in whose shade they will never sit.
Right.
Our society is not really one that does that.
No, it's not.
We are more of a cocaine yuppie yacht club society. So, you know,
absolutely.
It's very challenging to develop technologies like this if there isn't an immediate profit that can be gained from it. Of course, I think it could be extremely profitable because there are many, many places where plastic waste is an enormous cost. There are MRFs, there are municipal waste, you know, disposal. That, you know, the average Target or Publix or whoever spends thousands of dollars a month per store on plastic and waste disposal. So there is a market for it. But like you said, getting that technology, scaling it up, like even going from the 5-liter bioreactor to the 55-liter bioreactor that's thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars. And, you know, it's not going to produce profit when you're at that scale. To be profitable, you have to be at a big, big scale. And unfortunately, my background and my team's background is not one that is well suited to raising, you know, doing multi-million dollar rounds, investment rounds. Now, we are very lucky. We have a benefactor, a nonprofit, Four Roots, that has been helping us a lot. But it's still a long road before we are likely going to see any kind of major investment like that. So if anyone listening to this is like $1 billion.
maybe just like throw it your way.
$25 million they can throw our direction. That would be really nice.
Well, it's commonly known that every one of my audience members, my listeners, have, you know, in the millions of dollars laying around. So I'll make sure that they reach out to you. No, I think doing these types of podcasts for you is important, because the more people that hear it, the more publicity. And maybe they do reach someone who says, you know what, I'm a philanthropist. This is important. Like, let's see what we can do, and let's actually get some movement. Okay, I have one part of your process that I want to talk about. Mm-hmm. It's the troubling part of the process for me. You talk about how recycling doesn't work, and we've done episodes on the podcast about recycling, and there's this thing called advanced recycling, which I'm sure you're familiar with, which is basically just the idea that we can take plastics, we can put it through the process of pyrolysis, we can then take those plastics or that liquid that we create, and we can create fuel from it. So then they take it through a process to create fuel. And anyway, it's greenwashing in a lot of ways. It creates a lot of very dangerous chemicals in the atmosphere, benzenes, cancer causing things, because they basically have to refine the fuel. So it's going through all the same processes and worse, because it's taking plastics and it's throwing stuff in the atmosphere. Yes. So a lot of people look at the advanced recycling and say, this is actually, it's just a for-profit way of talking about getting rid of plastics, but creating more problems. What you're talking about doing here is very different because you are taking plastics, you are creating a end product that does not have any plastics in it and is actually a organic fertilizer, which is amazing. But there is one part of this that is similar to the advanced, which is the pyrolysis.
Yes.
So talk us through, essentially, you're not just taking like a styrofoam container from a takeout container and dropping it in the bioreactor. I think you tried that and it worked, but it was way less efficient because it has to break it all down from its current state. Instead, you do put it through the pyrolysis process. Can you explain what that is?
Yes. So, and this is very important to point out. So pyrolysis, and there are a lot of pyrolysis firms that you mentioned, is a process where you take some material and you heat it up in the absence of oxygen. And by doing that, what you hope to do is thermally crack it, to break it apart into its constituent components, or to, by catalysts, process into some other smaller third-party component. So this is done a lot with industrial materials. Tires, famously, are pyrolyzed in vast scales in China and other places because they can take the tires, the rubber, the synthetic rubber in those tires, they can break that back down into lubricants, fuel oil, you know, other kinds of materials. And as you point out, a lot of the outgassing of that, because they're usually very poorly constructed pyrolysis plants, can be aromatic, polyaromatic hydrocarbons or other aromatic hydrocarbons, which are by and large very, very bad. They are carcinogenic. Benzene is the basis of many of these compounds. And as we know, benzene is very, very poisonous. But of course, we get lots of other things that come out of it as well. But pyrolysis is a very broad term. Pyrolysis covers everything from a person making charcoal in their backyard with a rocket stove up to a microwave-powered plant that is vaporizing CD cases. So it can cover a very, very wide gamut. So what we call pyrolysis for us actually encompasses several different processes. One of the big ones is with things like polystyrene, we do want to get styrene out of it. We want to get the monomer out of it. The styrene monomer is much more edible by our microbes than polystyrene as a whole is. Mm-hmm. Now, we have, like I said, like you mentioned, tried using the polymer just as a food source, and it does work to some degree, but it's very, very slow in comparison. So we want to process as much plastic as possible, and we want to do that as fast as possible. So what we do is we like to pyrolyze the polystyrene in order to get the styrene out of it so that we can feed that liquid into our bioreactor. But you do point out there are other byproducts that are produced. Now, the good news is, in a lot of other plants, they are very much concerned with the energy they're putting in versus the energy they're getting out. Because, you know, they're trying to make fuels, and so it becomes very much an energy, a game of energy. For us, we don't really care about that so much. We're trying to make calories. We're trying to make food for our bacteria. So when we have excess emissions or material, we just vaporize that. We burn that, and by burning it, yes, we're yielding CO2 from the process, but we're also eliminating a lot of these polyaromatic hydrocarbons. And by burning it, you get a little bit of energy back out of it, which is good to run the pyrolysis process some more. The other thing that we do is for other plastics, especially things like PET or HDP or other stuff, we don't actually pyrolyze it really. What we do is we just heat it up warm enough so that the plastic starts to decrystallize. It starts to sort of melt. But we don't actually want it to start to aerosolize. We don't want it to start to chemically really break down. We just want to make the crystal structure break down a little bit more so that it's a lot easier for our bacteria and enzymes to attack it. And so what we're aiming to do in the future is have a facility where all of the pyrolysis that does occur is basically entirely contained. So any material that goes through the process is either completely converted into a liquid fraction, which goes straight into the bioreactor, and the gas fraction is just essentially incinerated for more energy. That way there's no emissions and there's no, you know, outgassing of anything toxic. And any of the other plastics that we can, we will just decrystallize them by heating, but not through an actual really pyrolytic process. Now, a process that's not really chemically changing them on a molecular level. So that's how I would address that. I would say, generally speaking, a lot of the problems around pyrolysis have less to do with the fundamental chemistry involved and more to do with the industrial equipment involved.
The application of it.
Exactly. A good pyrolysis plant should have basically no emissions other than CO2 and water. Because if you pyrolyze a material, plastic, you're going to get a lot of gases and other stuff out of it, but you can capture those and cool those down through apparatus, through, you know, various capturing methods to pump them back into a pyrolysis chamber, into a different incineration chamber, to get energy out of it, which you'd want to do anyway, because you're leaving free energy on the table. Well, not free, but you're leaving an energy rebate on the table.
Right.
And so it's really more of a matter of people being lazy with how they do pyrolysis than anything else. But I would also point out that pyrolysis as a solution for plastics alone is not a very good one, because what they're trying to get out of a lot of these other pyrolysis plants are specific yields. They're trying to get specific, like they want toluene, they want benzoic acid, they want some specific chemical yield. And in doing so, that's where you end up getting like weird mixtures of emissions that they end up dumping rather than trying to
recover. They're pulling very specific things out, and the waste stuff, they're like, well, we don't want to have to deal with this. Just shoot it up in the atmosphere, burn it, whatever.
Yes.
Whereas for you, you're like, we'll take pretty much all of it. The worm biome, the microbiome is going to eat like the vast majority, and whatever is not getting eaten, we'll just use to power the pyrolysis process.
Yes.
And then all that's being emitted like is CO2 is what you're saying. So
yeah, like, let me give you an example. So if you're a pyrolysis plant with like polystyrene and plastic, PET and HDPE and all this other stuff, and you only want to produce styrene, or let's say you only want to produce toluene, the temperature you need to run it at is very specific. And when you run it at that temperature, you're also going to get benzoic acid, and you're also going to get benzene, and you're also going to get all these other aromatic things. But because you only want toluene, your equipment is going to be focused on separating that toluene out from those other compounds. So you're going to be putting a lot of energy into getting those things out of the system. So your pyrolyzer is going to want to run at the same temperature with the same catalysts all the time. And when you get those things out of it, you're going to kind of just want to get rid of them, dump them. You're not going to want to have a separate machine for burning them to make more energy, because you are right now working on trying to get the toluene put somewhere else.
Right.
So for us, we don't really care if it's toluene or benzene or benzoic acid. As long as it's a digestible aromatic hydrocarbon, we'll take all of it. And anything that isn't digestible is not going to be in the liquid fraction. It's going to be a gas, or it's going to be a solid. And if it's a gas, then we're going to incinerate it. We're going to burn it as syngas. And if it's a solid, we're going to continue pyrolyzing it until it turns into ash, until it turns into carbon.
And what do you do with that ash and carbon?
That can be used for biochar.
Okay.
So, I mean, it's not technically biochar, but it is a carbon material. So you can mix it in with biochars. You can mix it in with soil amendments. And you can also even use it as activated carbon. So activated carbon has a lot of uses in the electrochemical industry. It can be used as a dielectric in supercapacitors. It can be used as a filtrant. So it has all these other applications. But you're only going to get to that ash carbon for, you know, the 10 or 20% of solid fraction that gets left behind that you have to totally pyrolyze all the way to the end.
Yeah. So the hope is, in the end, that the going through the whole process, you're eliminating any pollutants other than CO2. You're not having any sort of waste that is becoming a pollutant, whether it be in the atmosphere or a solid. All of it should be able to either power the machine itself or go back into the worm biome and become your tea in the end.
Yes. And the vast majority, so 60-70%, is going to become basically worm chow one way or another. And what's great about that is what happens at the end of that is it becomes fertilizer, and fertilizer becomes plant matter, which becomes carbon sequestration.
Yeah, totally. So it would be interesting, and I know this is one of those things that needs money and research and time, but it would be interesting to know how much plastic are we consuming per CO2 output for running the plant, and how much are we re-sequestering through the end product, right? And obviously, it doesn't need to be a net positive, because you're eliminating plastic. Like, if we can eliminate plastic, it's, in my opinion, it's worth putting some CO2 into the air. It's going to be, I looked into the amount of CO2 that most pyrolysis units create, and it's like minimal in comparison with the amount of plastic that you're able to remove. I mean, it's negligible. You look at like a city of 200,000 people and the amount of CO2 it produces. And then you look at your pyrolysis unit that could eliminate all of the plastics for that entire community. And it's like laughable how little CO2 it is.
Yeah.
Comparison. So I don't have a problem necessarily with saying, oh, we're creating more CO2 by getting rid of plastics because it's negligible. But it would be cool to know, like, what are the actual numbers, and does it become a net positive by being able to sequester more plastics through healthy fertilizers causing them?
Yeah. And I don't know. And ultimately, this is not a plastic, or this is not a carbon sequestration business. This is elimination business. So that is another huge challenge facing humanity that, as much as I hate to say it, will kind of have to be someone else who will need to solve that.
You can only do so much, Sam.
But solving the majority of the plastic problem, I think, is good. And to be clear, I actually do think incineration is a good route to go for a lot of the other plastics. So for like PVC and stuff, I think incineration is necessary, because those plastics are just going to become worse and worse and worse the more they sit in the environment. And there's not a good way to... Recycling, like I said, just doesn't really work. You're always losing more into the environment than you're ever getting rid of. So,
right.
And countries like Sweden do this a lot. They have plants where they're using waste plastic to make electricity, to warm homes.
Interesting. Just
plastic is a fuel source at the end of the day. We're using it as a biological fuel, but it can also be used as a thermal fuel. I don't think it's good to do that for all plastics. If there's an off-ramp to use them as a biological fuel and to export that biological process outside the plant, that's even better. But in cases where that cannot be done, like with PVCs, then I think incineration is just the way to go.
Random. This is random, but like, what's the byproduct of incineration for PVC? Like, does it, you know, is it polluting? What does that do?
Oh, it depends on the temperature you run the incineration at. So the hotter the incineration burns, the closer you get to bed to pure combustion. So low temperature combustion will yield lots of dirty, horrific smoke and other compounds. So a professional incineration plant will run very hot in order to get closer and closer to CO2. Now, you will get, when you incinerate PVC, hydrogen chloride, which is very, very bad. That's hydrochloric acid's precursor, because you've chlorine in PVC. It's polyvinyl chloride. However, chlorine can be neutralized by turning it into salt. If you use sodium and use other things, you can turn chlorine into pretty useful and benign substances. And that's what they do in a lot of plants, like in Sweden and Europe and other places. They take their plastics, they incinerate it, and they recapture these noxious compounds so that they don't enter the environment. And there's been a lot of talk about, too, using the CO2 from these plants to power like greenhouses and stuff, you know, pump them into places where you're growing plants as a way to sequester them. I think this could be potentially very useful for growing like algae and other things like that in the future. But that's, again, we're getting right beyond my pay grade.
Absolutely. Well, I can say that I genuinely hope, you know, $100 million falls in your lap so that you can really scale it up. I hope that the technology, because if what everything that you've talked about here, if it's all what you say it is, and it all works the way that you say it will, and like there's no reason why humanity should not be like converging together. There's no reason there shouldn't be a GoFundMe that's got $1 trillion in it for Sam to go out and do this, you know.
But nice.
It's just the world we live in, and it's like you said, it's the society that cares about ROI, it cares about me, it's the private investors who want a massive return that kind of prevent these things from taking shape. I believe that you can do it. I believe that you can continue to scale. I don't know at what rate you'll scale, but I hope that it's rapid, and I hope that it changes the world. Sam, I appreciate you being here. You have given me some places where my audience can find you, where they can contact you if they have questions, suggestions, thoughts, ideas. So I will make sure that that's all available to them, and good luck with your projects.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate it. And hopefully we can do a little bit to stave off collapse a little bit longer and not have microplastics in our brains.
Let's do it. Hey, Corey here. If you are listening to the back catalog of Breaking Down Collapse, thank you. Those episodes are so vital. They're so important.
But I also wanted to let you know that I am now doing daily episodes. Yes, that's right. Here on the podcast, daily episodes. So if you are enjoying the back catalog, great. Please also feel free to zoom forward to the most recent episodes. Catch us daily. They are quick little episodes, and I think you'll enjoy them. Thanks.